don't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No, we won't take it, said a voice from the crowd. No, you won't pass policy that holds us down.
Welcome to the final Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. In the first hour, I will start the show with Racine Mayor John Dickert. We will be discussing the state budget. And I will end the first hour with Rebecca Campbell from the Progressive Magazine and Wisconsin Citizens Media Co-op. We'll be talking about where the schools might be headed and more rights being taken away from us in the Capitol, and any late-breaking news that maybe I haven't seen coming up in the last 5-10 hours, because goodness knows in Fitzwalkerstan how things break, and they always seem to break on a Friday evening or in the middle of the night. But right now, I'd like to welcome Mayor John Dickert to the Sarah Schultz Show. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning. How are you?
I am good. How are you doing this morning?
Great, great. Busy morning already.
As always, Racine is a pretty busy city.
You know, now, we got a lot of things going on, so it really is.
Now, the state budget that Walker created has really affected cities and towns and villages. And with a larger city like Racine, how have you guys been affected with that?
Well, really, there's two things of major importance. The first one was Act 10 and Act 32. When the two were passed, obviously the one dealt with labor union rights and the rights of bargaining within cities and within communities. That had an impact on us, obviously, because of the fact that how we have to deal with our laborers and how we have to deal with our budgets. The other act allowed the state to, in essence, stop all what they call tax increases for city residents. But really what they did was they froze the levy. And let me explain what that means. For a lot of people out there who don't understand levy limits, shared revenue, and things like that, what the state said in essence was the cities aren't smart enough to run their own governments, so we're going to tell them how to run their governments. Now, that would be fine if the state was in the same type of fiscal situation that cities are in, which most cities are in a far better situation fiscally than the state is, and far more efficient and effective with their financing than the states are. But what the state came down and did is said, well, we're going to freeze your levy. So in other words, you as a city of Racine can never raise taxes again. And people say, oh, well, that's no big deal. For how long? Well, the problem is forever. Now, let me give you the scenario of how this fits and how it would fit to the normal family. Let's say, Sarah, you're out there and you're working in the real world and you're making $50,000 a year. Well, you would never, for the rest of your life, get a raise. Now, the prices of your insurance are going to go up, price of gas is going to go up, the price of food is going to go up, price of clothing, maybe even going out to the movie theater, dinner, all those things are going to go up that you cannot control. But you're always going to have a salary of $50,000 a year. Well, we all know, as hardworking residents of our cities and communities, that there's no way you can live on that, because eventually you'll have to start dropping off things. Things will have to be put on the wayside. You won't be able to go to the theater. You won't be able to go out to eat as often. You won't be able to buy new clothes all the time. You won't be able to go shopping all the time. So that's what's happened to cities. The state legislature has said that you can never raise taxes again in the city, and therefore what we have to do as cities is we are forced to reduce services. And that's the only outcome of this entire act, Act 32 that was passed, is that we are going to be forced to cut services every single year. That is not a good situation for cities, and it's most definitely not a good situation for our residents.
Where are the places that you feel that you have to cut because the state's not helping out with any of this?
Well, the places that we have to cut, unfortunately, are services that people enjoy, services that make your community a great community to live in, that create a greater quality of life. What we have done because of these cuts is we've prepared for a lot of them. And we knew that whether Governor Walker or Mayor Barrett were going to come in, we knew that we were going to be facing fiscal challenges because of the economy. So we as a city prepared for them by finding efficiencies, we created a joint dispatch here that saved the city and the community millions of dollars. We did a lot of things to, in essence, prepare for what we knew was a bad economy. And we did those for 2 or 3 years. But now, unfortunately, because the governor has said and the state legislature has said that we can never raise taxes, now we're seeing things like we're cutting the amount of days that we pick up garbage. We're cutting off streetlights. We're turning off streetlights. We're shutting down parks and community centers. Eventually, it's going to get to a point where, you know, we have one of the best beaches in the country and one of the top 200 beaches in the world. Well, we have that beach because we clean it every day. We make sure that we keep our stormwater clean. We do a lot of things every single day to make sure that that beach stays as pristine as it is. We may have to close the beach. And when you think about it, this is why this is such a detrimental piece of legislation. The city of Racine estimates that we have between 100 and 200,000 people, because we don't count after 5 o'clock at night. We have between 100 and 200,000 people that attend that beach every year. They go to the Oasis, they listen to music, they have a cocktail, they have lunch, they do whatever. But 100 to 200,000 people a year visit that beach. That beach also helps attract 5 major sporting events throughout the year. Ironman Triathlon, Lighthouse Run, EVP Beach Volleyball Tournament. All of that brings us in about $5 million in tourism revenue per year. Well, if we have to shut the beach down, now, in essence, you've cut out at least, on the minimum, $5 million in tourism. So what has happened is the legislators in Madison aren't thinking about the long-term ramifications of their decisions. As a matter of fact, they're extraordinarily short-thinking or short-term thinking in the way that they legislate. So what they're not realizing is by simply stating something like, you can never raise taxes again in Act 32, you are, in essence, killing cities. Slowly but surely, you're killing cities. And this can't continue because you can't keep up the quality of life. You can't keep up the infrastructure that drive businesses to your community. If you don't have a good quality infrastructure, if you don't have good quality schools and low crime and opportunities for your kids and your families to do, to enjoy themselves and entertain themselves in cities, you can't attract businesses here. So, you know, this is all a cyclical thing. One component affects the next and the next and the next. So what we're trying to do is to get the legislature to start thinking before they make decisions like this, because you can't ask us as a city to attract more businesses and cut unemployment when you've taken away every vehicle for us to do that.
So there really is, well, actually I should say it this way. Is there any way that the cities and villages and towns can actually raise money?
Well, the only way that you can do it is by development. And if you bring in new development and new growth. Well, here's the problem with that very scenario. We're talking to developers. We're talking to investors. We're talking to folks that want to come and look at our community. And the first couple of things that they ask me is, Mayor, how's your infrastructure? In other words, can I get my water, my utilities, my employees, all to my business quickly and efficiently? Well, the first thing that I have to tell them is that the transportation side of our infrastructure in this area is not strong enough to really attract big businesses and even medium-sized businesses. So that's one component that's hurting us. Then the second thing is they say, how's the education and how's the crime? Well, crime right now in Racine is at a 40-year low, but now Congress has just stripped the funding away for us to go in and even create a better opportunity for crime. The state has stripped our money away so we can't pay, and we'll probably have to be cutting back firefighters and police officers. So once again, here we're facing difficulties here to attract these businesses. Then lastly, they say, how's the education? Well, the $1.6 billion was just cut out of the education system. So while these businesses are coming here to ask us to provide those things that they need to locate, all those things that we'd like to work with them on, we have no opportunity to work with them on. So if we're only supposed to be able to grow our taxes by development and new levy, how are we supposed to do that if every opportunity for us to bring in those new developers to create that new, those new taxes have been stripped out of cities? It's really a no-win situation for cities. And the worst part about that, Sarah, is that the national studies that have been done by the economic firms that we as mayors talk to and get our advice from have stated that over the next 20 to 50 years, 94% of the country's growth, 94% will come from cities and metro areas. So if 94% of the future growth of this country is going to come from cities and metro areas, why would anyone in elected office strip away the very availability for us to do our job, to create those jobs?
Well, that's kind of going to my next question. How often have you been able to get this out into the newspaper, the radio, the TV? Because really, none of this really makes sense. The legislature, it's doing exactly what you're saying. It's destroying the cities. Why would you want to destroy the one thing that brings income into the state, or one of the few things that bring income into the state?
Well, there's been in the last couple of budgets, there has been this shift of funds from cities to the suburban areas. Well, not only is that a disastrous opportunity because of what I just described, because it's not going to create you any growth, but we see that. We see that right here in Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a perfect example. We are lagging behind every state in the union for job growth. And the reason that we're doing that is because of the shift of money from the cities to the suburban areas. And one thing that I'm sure we'll talk about soon enough is that what that does is that because the costs of shifting money to suburbs and growth outside of cities exponentiates the actual cost of government, you can see why we're failing in job growth here. And let me explain that. When you go out to suburbs and you build new areas, you have to build new infrastructure, new roads, new opportunities, new electricity. You have to build all the infrastructure components that allow a suburb to grow. All of those components are already in a city. So why would you build out farther to make people drive cars and take longer times to commute? Because that price is not sustainable. That cost is not sustainable. You have to build new schools if there are enough people out there. You have to build new pumping stations for your water and your sewer and your electric and your gas and everything else. You have to build basically little cities out in areas where you already have the infrastructure for them to grow within metro areas. So it's really unsustainable. The one, though, that is probably, I think, the most detrimental to the state of Wisconsin is the fact that one of the biggest shifts that we've seen in this last couple of budgets is the shift from transportation funds from cities out into highways, into areas that as we always say here in the cities, that see more deer than they see cars. And when you start building infrastructure and highways out that far, you add to commutes and congestion. And congestion costs every single transportation driver, car driver in the country, every single driver $713 a year. That's what congestion costs every single person. So why would you do that? It's not logical, it's not sustainable, and it's not efficient. So that's why we're asking the legislature to reevaluate their decision-making.
Because of the costs that you're talking about, especially the costs of the maintenance of roads that keeps going up exponentially every year, basically, do you feel that the budget itself it encourages borrowing?
Well, the unfortunate part is if you're going to attempt to retain your long-term projects and ideals and infrastructure and things like that, the only opportunity that you have really is to borrow. But I'm a fiscal conservative. I don't believe in borrowing a lot of money, and I don't believe in laying long-term debt onto the people that are going to follow me. Now, unfortunately, this legislature has proven differently, and they don't seem to have a problem with borrowing excessive amounts of money and or leaving that debt onto cities. And here's the problem with that, though, and this is what confuses me as a mayor, and it confuses me completely. The same people who have created this monster debt over the last 8 or 10 years, the same folks who have created this huge, incredible debt are the same ones complaining that it's there. And I, as a mayor and mayors around the country, just shake our heads when we see that, because if you have no place to go, the option, obviously, is to go to long-term debt. We try to do that as little as possible here in the city of Racine, because I know what that means in the future. And what I'm hoping that the legislature does, whether it's in Madison or in Washington, is something that I haven't seen them do in decades, which is start making their decisions based on our children, not on the next tweet that comes across on their cell phone. You know, we have to make decisions, and we make decisions here in Racine based on our kids. We, you know, we work for today, but we prepare for tomorrow. And what I don't see happening in Madison or Washington is that same, you know, fiscally responsible ideal. It's just, well, pass on the debt, and we'll have somebody else worry about it. And then when it becomes an issue, then you complain about it. I think that's why the American public is so frustrated with Washington and Madison, is because of this constant, you know, don't do as I say, don't do as I do. And it's very frustrating for us as mayors, because once the, you know, the debt hits Madison or Washington, well, then they just dump it on us at the local level, and we're asked to take care of it. So it's been very frustrating, but I try to stay away from that type of budgeting where you transfer all of your costs to debt, because it's really a bad path.
One last question, because I know you've got to get going. Are you able to get the ear of your local senator and your local assembly person and or your representative in Congress? Or even our senators? Is anyone listening to you as you're speaking this, as you're saying this stuff?
Well, I think that they listen to it. The question is to whether anybody hears it. And the reason I say that is because what I find, and I think what most mayors around the country find, is that Madison and Washington are so engaged in fighting that I don't know that they're listening to anyone. The question that I always ask people is, listen to the folks, the elected officials on TV, and ask yourself when the last time they said, well, my constituents believe. What everybody talks about right now is party politics, and I think constituents have had enough of that. They need to start talking about their districts and representing their districts. I do talk to our local representatives that are here. Some of them listen, some of them obviously don't. But the thing that, you know, we've been trying to get across lately is that, you know, you as a Congress and you as a state are constantly talking about roads, roads, roads. And roads are unsustainable, and we know that. And we're going down the wrong path by constantly building new highways. The Michigan study that came out recently showed that highways and constantly building roads will bankrupt our future. It'll bankrupt our children. It'll bankrupt the country. We have to start thinking about being smarter and more efficient with our transportation, and we have to think about it as a nation, because if we don't, I can guarantee you that it will bankrupt the state and it'll bankrupt the country. And if it does that, it'll definitely impact the cities. So I'm hoping, we're working on it as mayors together to try to get everybody to evaluate the most efficient, effective way to move people, because you oftentimes hear that we've got to get off of foreign oil. Well, I'd like to see somebody actually do something about it instead of telling me about it. And they can do something about it by actually evaluating the problems that we have and working on them in a way that makes this world a better place for our kids.
Well, Mayor Dickert, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking about that.
Oh, it's good talking to you, Sarah. I hope you have a great day.
Well, thank you. You too.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Mayor John Dickert from Racine, who was talking about the budget. Obviously, some of those cuts that we did, it really does affect you, is what it comes down to. It affects you through affecting the cities and bankrupting the cities. You're listening to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and on now is Rebecca Kemble from the Progressive Magazine and from Wisconsin Citizen Media Co-op. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Sarah.
Well, thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, and I'm really glad, and this is my last show, and I'm glad that you could be on it, because you are, have been so good at just giving so much information, and there's some things I wanted to touch back with you, and so I'm glad I have you for a little bit of extended period of time and have you on.
Excellent. And I'm sorry, it's your last show.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm eventually, I'd like to get back into radio. We'll see what happens, but right now it's just not doable. So
yeah.
It's just the way life goes sometimes. But I wanted to start off with I believe it was Yuri who brought up a story that you wrote about second degrees and not funding second degrees. And I was wondering if you could start off with that, because I wanted to touch a lot about it, or touch on education today.
Okay, well, this was actually a very small piece of recommendations that Tim Sullivan, who is the chair of a couple committees involving workforce development in the state of Wisconsin, had in a report he released this week. He presented it to Governor Walker on Monday and then presented it to a joint meeting of the Council on Workforce Investment and the College and Workforce Readiness Council on Tuesday. So what this report was about the state of workforce development and how to improve workforce development and resources for it in the state. And by workforce development, he means education and training for jobs, but not just any jobs in the state. Really, he's talking about getting more and more people into the manufacturing sector. So that's the context here. And a couple of committees Tim Sullivan himself and Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and another group called Competitive Wisconsin, they've been working on trying to raise the profile of manufacturing businesses in the state for a long time, and they have specifically been targeting public education for at least 6 years as a way to get more public education resources to be geared towards training people to work in factories and manufacturing plants. So this was a big 126-page report authored by him. I thought it was interesting that it only had his name on it, although he presented it as somehow as the work of these two workforce investment and workforce development committees. But really it turns out it was just authored by him. And these are really his ideas and the ideas of a very small group of people in the state who now have political power and want to press their advantage. So half of the recommendations, there were 14 recommendations, and it's available on the Department of Administration website, this report is. Half of the 14 involve changes to public education, and one of those changes is, as you mentioned, it is to increase tuition for people in the technical college or any of the state colleges or universities who have already received one degree. So if Tim Sullivan put it in a really crass way. He said, you know, the taxpayer shouldn't have to pay for someone to do a do-over if they made a mistake with their first degree. And so basically no state subsidies should go to people who are going back to school, to college, which is totally against even traditional ideas of workforce development, which is, if you know you've been trained in a certain career and in a certain field and the jobs go away and you're unemployed, the state would provide retraining. I mean, that's the whole idea of the Wisconsin Job Center and workforce development. But here is Sullivan saying no, if the individual screwed up and made a bad choice the first time, then the state shouldn't have to subsidize a degree through lower subsidized state tuition at state institutions.
All right, I'm going to stop you right there real fast before we go on, because I'd like to remind people who Sullivan is and what organization he's been with, because I know you went into it before, but I'd like to just remind people who this person is.
Okay, Tim Sullivan, up until the end, up until last year, he was the CEO of Bucyrus International Incorporated, which was one of the largest mining equipment manufacturers in the world. In 2010-2011, he brokered a deal with Caterpillar to sell Bucyrus to Caterpillar for $8.6 million. That deal went through, and as part of that deal, Caterpillar moved its worldwide mining division headquarters to South Milwaukee and Oak Creek. And now Caterpillar's mining division is the largest mining equipment manufacturer in the whole world. And they also manufacture for, you know, their earth moving and machines, and they're used a lot for military purposes as well, and road building and construction and whatnot. So Tim Sullivan retired after that sale, and he has been quote unquote volunteering for the state of Wisconsin as a Walker appointed workforce development czar. So basically, he's been given it's an incredible amount of power he's been given, and I've been witnessing this in terms of his interpersonal relationships with leaders of state agencies who seem to really view him as a leader and as someone who has power over them. For example, Kevin Riley, the president of the UW system, he at the last month's meeting of the College and Workforce Readiness Council, of which he is a member, Tim Sullivan was letting them know that he was going to unveil this report at their meeting. And he alluded to the fact that it would have major changes for public education. And Kevin Riley almost begged Tim Sullivan to give him an advance copy of the report, because he has stakeholders that he's accountable to for his response to the report, namely chancellors and, you know, students and everyone who is a stakeholder in the UW, University of Wisconsin system. And Tim Sullivan basically told him, well, you know, this is just the start of a discussion. You don't really need an advance copy of my report. You'll see it when everyone else sees it. And as it turns out, Riley didn't even show up to this meeting on Tuesday where the report was unveiled. He sent some other people in his stead. So it's really alarming that someone like Tim Sullivan and his cronies in the manufacturing industry have their hands on the levers of state policy to this great extent. Now, the biggest proposal recommendation in this report has to do with how the technical college system, the university system, and K-12 education is funded. And it's always been a problem. Funding formulas have been a problem and have been difficult in Wisconsin for public schools. But he's proposing something so outrageous and that has failed in so many other states, and proposing it as just, oh, it's just a common sense solution and we should do this. And it's something called performance-based funding, where part of a school district or a college or a university's funding from the state would be based on certain measurable performance outcomes. And some of the performance outcomes that Tim Sullivan is talking about is, you know, how many graduates of a high school or technical college are going into manufacturing jobs. You know, so he put it in terms of, and I'm quoting him, creating an atmosphere in which school leaders find it easy to do the right thing. Some other, you know, there are other ways to put that, but it's really forcing our public institutions to serve a specific sector of the business community in a way that's really unprecedented for public agencies.
Welcome back to the Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz. And I'm speaking with Rebecca Campbell from the Progressive Magazine and the Wisconsin Citizen Media Co-op. Now, we are discussing about education, and really, this is a real get-out-the-vote issue for young people, for anyone in Wisconsin. If you're young and in school, if you're a parent with kids in school, if you're a grandparent with grandchildren in school, these are you should all be concerned about the real freedoms and opportunities for your children and grandchildren. I mean, this is really serious stuff. We're talking about not having the freedom to choose the job you want, but having the schools corral the kids into positions, whether the children or the parents want that or not, because that's what's going to benefit the schools financially. So, Rebecca, what kind of traction is this idea really getting right now?
Well, it's hard to say, and I think even Sullivan and his cronies at WMC and Competitive Wisconsin aren't exactly sure. They're just waiting to see how the November elections shake out, although there is a special legislative council study committee called Improving Educational Opportunities in High School that is all about this effort, actually. So they're laying the groundwork for writing legislation to allow this and, you know, other initiatives to go through in January. And I think they're hoping if, you know, the Republicans take back the Senate, they'll just be able to ram through whatever changes they want. And it's all going through and being approved by Walker's office ahead of time, and it's being approved and getting buy-in from this legislative committee, including Senator Tim Cullen is on this committee, and he's all for it. So I'm not saying he's all for every one of the proposals in the Sullivan report, because I haven't gotten a comment from him after the report was released, but he's all for the basic idea. The basic ideas behind it, he's made comments in that special legislative committee supporting that and supporting. He is a big supporter of Tim Sullivan. And it's even more alarming than you know, the funding of school issues. They're talking about getting manufacturers and business leaders to actually start writing curriculum, and it all flows into this, you know, this greater movement in public education nationally and internationally, I might add, of number one, privatizing public education, and number two, turning education into basically standardized test-taking factories, turning our schools into not teaching our kids to think, but teaching our kids to take tests well. And that's what, you know, President Obama's Race to the Top initiative is based on. That's what our new, Wisconsin just received a waiver for the No Child Left Behind law, but that waiver is forcing the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction to rely more and more and more on standardized testing for quote-unquote accountability purposes. That's also going to get turned into, you know, teachers' quality of work environment and hiring and firing and promotion, their abilities to get promoted and their pay scales, and it's really a giant push to completely transform public education as we've known it.
Well, that's obviously one of the reasons they had to get rid of the union, so they could do all the stuff they wanted to do, because the unions were actually the balance out to pushing some of this agenda through. They were the ones that were saying, no, we actually need a better environment, and that's not the way we see a better environment. Now, with manufacturing, we keep losing manufacturing jobs out of the state of Wisconsin like crazy. How are they expecting to bring manufacturing jobs in to push these kids into manufacturing positions?
Well, the truth is, I don't think even Walker's Department of Workforce Development, their own data shows that manufacturing is way down on the list of, you know, growing careers and growing needs for workforce. So it's really, I don't think they actually expect to create a whole lot more jobs unless they can attract new manufacturing businesses to the state. My sense is that they just want to divert some of the budgets for their purposes to subsidize their own industries. But they're doing it in the name of job creation, much like Governor Walker did, running his 2010 campaign saying this is all about jobs, 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 and I'm going to create 250,000 jobs in my first term. Well, you know, that is, as every month goes by and as more jobs are lost than are created in this state, that's really been seen to be just a pretext and a crass kind of political ploy that he doesn't really have a plan for creating jobs. And my sense is it's the same thing with this initiative, that it's really just a political pretext to grab more public resources for a certain section of the private sector to subsidize them. So, and in fact, at a meeting, it was at the Joint Finance Committee meeting, Bob Jauch, this was about 2 weeks ago, Bob Jauch made the point that, look, the Technical College in Superior is graduating welders, all of whom are getting jobs. Every single welder who is graduating from that college is getting a job, but they're not getting jobs in Wisconsin. They're getting jobs in the North Dakota oil fields and fracking fields because they're paying a lot more money out there for welders than any of the Wisconsin businesses are. So Wisconsin's claim, Tim Sullivan and Wisconsin manufacturers claim that there aren't enough students going through our technical college system to meet their needs is just false. Basically, the reality is that they're not willing, Wisconsin employers aren't willing to pay welders a competitive market wage, and workers are going elsewhere.
Do you think that they're really looking to create a modern-day medieval society, basically a serfdom made up of unskilled laborers?
If you elaborate all of these policy recommendations and many of the policies that have already been passed, that's what our society is going to look like. That, you know, the haves and the gap between the haves and the have-nots and the owners and the workers in society is going to increase. And I think they've been emboldened by by Walker's, you know, apparent winning of the recall election. And they saw that, you know, despite really unprecedented and historical uprisings, popular uprisings a year and a half ago, they were still able to get their policies through. So they're counting on people to just stay asleep, to either not vote, to turn a blind eye towards irregularities in our election processes, and to just take whatever comes down the road. So
with the privatization, the privatizing public schools, what is the overall goal, do you think, is they want to accomplish? What is it they're going to get out? Is it they can, again, direct people, like they set up a school where if you get a job at this company because we're setting you up to work at this company, or do you see something broader going on here? Is it more government handouts to businesses?
Yeah, it is something broader. It's corporate welfare. And as our natural resources on the planet become further and further depleted, these corporations, especially the natural resource extractive ones like the mining equipment company and mines and the defense industry, have to turn to other sources of profit making, since the natural resource itself is becoming harder and harder to make a profit on. So they're turning on human beings and human labor as a way to make profits. And if you think about corporate welfare, if basically what corporate welfare is, it's taking the money of working people who pay taxes, because people who own things, who don't work for a living but make their money on investments, they can hide all their income and pay no taxes. It's the working people who have to pay taxes. That's our money in the state and federal budgets. And now they're coming after the fruits of working people's labor, and they're coming after labor itself as a way to just increase their profits. If you look at Caterpillar, there was a strike down in Illinois. I think they have just come to a settlement, but Caterpillar made something like $11 billion in profit last year, and yet they're still demanding more and more and more concessions from their workers from this factory. And not because, you know, they made a loss and they need workers to help, you know, share the pain, but just because the corporation needs to deliver value to its shareholders. And they're delivering that not on producing anything, but on immiserating and exploiting workers more. And this is exactly what it's about, the whole privatization of education. And there's whole industries set up around justifying this. But really it's about individual corporations getting their hands on the public coffers, on public money.
That's pretty simple.
Yeah, it's pretty simple.
All right. We're going to continue talking with Rebecca. This is why I wanted her back on, because I feel this is such an important topic, and I'm going to keep you on as long as we need to get more information out on this. So
thanks, Sarah.
Hold on for a second, Rebecca. You're listening to The Sarah Schultz Show with Sarah Schultz, and we're speaking with Rebecca Campbell from the Progressive Magazine and the Wisconsin Citizen Media Co-op. Now, if you had an anthropological perspective on this, which you do because you have a degree in anthropology, what do you see is happening in our society right now? Do you see us evolving? Especially in the realm of education, do you see it de-evolving? And what do you see it de-evolving into? Or evolving into, depending on how you see it.
Well, I see this in terms of struggle. And, you know, evolution is always, on a species scale, evolution is taking place, and it takes place in, you know, on certain trajectories. At the same time that we have, you know, an unprecedented level of technological innovation and even human capacity building and the ability to what's going on is that it's a struggle between it's a crisis of capitalism, and we've seen this over and over and over again over the past 400-500 years. And each crisis, it's a crisis of accumulation of wealth under a certain economic system that we're under. And as I mentioned before, you know, the basis of that, which is labor and resources, gets more and more constrained, the struggles intensify. And that's what I see happening, is the intensification of all of these struggles and all of the contradictions of this mode of being on the planet coming to a head. And we're seeing it in Europe. We're seeing it all over the world, these economic crises, which they're not natural. They're not just something, you know, capitalism isn't just something that fell out of the sky. It's something that human beings developed. And I think a lot about this, that, you know, we are now basically slaves to a system that our ancestors, you know, in our species, and that we developed, and we can change that. But the way we change it is through organized struggle. And it's, you know, we're getting to a point where the conflict, this kind of conflict is going to be more and more and more high stakes. It's going to be more widespread. And, you know, you can't really predict how it's going to turn out, but you can see the forces at play. The Jim Hightower, you know, I just kind of want to get back to this education thing. The Jim Hightower piece you just played, really interesting, talking exactly about university professors owning shares in Halliburton and, you know, putting out research that supports fracking and the fracking industry. Well, I don't know if, you know, our listeners know, but the biggest funder of our geology department at the UW-Madison is Halliburton. And I think something like, you know, it's less than a third of the funding of our state universities comes actually from the state. Most of it is corporate funding. Now, one of Tim Sullivan's proposals, another one, is to not allow any research at our state universities that doesn't have a specific commercial purpose. And he spent a couple minutes talking about this. He says, why are we doing just pure research that isn't going to make the university or some corporation money? We should be like Stanford. Stanford evidently, and I haven't actually checked into this yet. I need to do some background research into it, but Stanford, for every research proposal that goes on in that university, they have to say what is the commercial gain going to be out of this research. So, you know, the Jim Hightower piece, that's not really scandalous in our world anymore. I mean, in fact, you know, we have proposals that say, no, not only is it okay for people doing research to be invested in what they're researching, but that there actually has to be an explicit commercial tie-in to research. So this is, you know, it's systemic. It's systemic.
Well, and there was an incident in Florida about a year or two ago. I think it was I can't remember, Florida State University, I think, but it was one of the Florida universities. And what happened was the Koch brothers actually donated $3-5 million to the university with the stipulation that we'll give you the money, but we want you to hire the professors that we approve. So that they were hiring professors that followed the thought process and followed what the Koch brothers believed, and that way they could teach that in that college, in that university. So it'd be taking the ideas and actually giving them some sort of a sustenance and some sort of legitimacy.
Yeah, and that's just the most direct. Yeah, that's just the most direct line of influence. I mean, there's the big one of the big gains of the right wing and the you know, a certain section of capitalism in our country that have made in the last 40 years is to develop these think tanks, and so that they don't actually have to directly hire professors, but to have a voice in public conversations that seems like it's just mainstream. So, you know, think tanks and organizations like the Manhattan Institute and the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation and the Heartland Institute, they are legitimized through people with credentials that have specific political purposes in mind, writing papers and getting their members appointed to government councils. And 40 years of this stuff, a lot of these ideas have been normalized and are passed off just as, you know, the consensus, the sort of a mainstream consensus about how things ought to be. And that's how we got to where we are in public education now, where you know, our federal education department is promoting these privatization policies, is promoting charter schools, is promoting standardized testing, is promoting indirectly the busting of unions. And it's not, you know, it's not really a conspiracy. It's a whole cultural shift whereby people with certain economic interests have completely taken control of, you know, of policy, of government policy over the course of several decades.
And the thing that's disturbing me with the public, or I'm sorry, the private schools, is that the public schools have, there's criteria, there's certain things teachers have to have, like a degree, a teaching certificate, they have to continuous education. There's standards involved in this. And with the private schools, there doesn't seem to be any standards involved with it. If you have a degree or don't have a degree, then you can get hired on no matter what it is, and it doesn't matter what. You could have a degree in, I don't know, basket weaving, and you can, now you're hired to teach math.
Yes, and actually the Wisconsin DPI just rolled out there earlier this week an alternative credentialing process whereby you don't need to have a teaching degree or really any degree at all. You can get credentialed through the DPI if you have work experience and can pass some tests made by the DPI. So our own state agencies are going along with this. And this, again, this is something that another recommendation of the Tim Sullivan report is that people can earn college degrees by not by going to a college and engaging in, with peers in a classroom and with professors and actually having relationships and having learning experiences in community, but they can gain college degrees by taking online what he's calling competency tests to pass through to different levels of achievement, take a couple online classes, and then they have a degree. So, it's really the complete hollowing out of what even education even is anymore.
So is there any – where do the children get involved? When do we actually start looking at what's best for the children and how the children should be educated? And when do we start looking at the future of our state, of our community, of this country? When does that become part of the conversation? When can we start focusing on that and let's start focusing less on how much these manufacturers can make off the children and off the education?
Well, I think the uprising last year started to open that conversation. The teachers' unions, that's what they're talking about. They're not just talking about their wages and benefits. They're talking about the quality of life for kids in the classroom. And they're talking about, bigger pictures of, in fact, the Chicago Teachers Union, who are likely going to go on strike very soon now. They authorized their leader to deliver a 10-day strike notice to the mayor and to the CEO of their public schools, which, by the way, Chicago doesn't have a publicly elected school board, and they haven't since 1995. So they're talking about, look, we need to change this conversation, and in order to change the conversation, it can't just be a couple people talking about it. There really has to be mass social action that stops business as usual and that asserts a different vision of our society and of people's place in society and children's place in society and workers' place in society, since we're the ones who actually create the wealth. It's got to be coupled through these, through actions in the struggle to really reclaim the commons, because what ultimately is happening is these corporations are really just destroying anything that we have as a society left in common with the commodification and privatization of everything. So, I think that's when we start talking about it in any meaningful way, is when we stop business as usual. And to do that, you need concerted, organized action against business as usual. So it'll be very interesting to see what goes on in Chicago this fall and how that work action takes shape.
That will be fun to watch. And if people want to follow more on what's going on with that and in education in general and in any of the writings that you do, what are the two websites they can go to?
It's the Wisconsin Citizens Media Cooperative, WCMCOOP.com, and the Progressive Magazine at progressive.org.
Rebecca, thank you so much for being on again. As always, you are full of amazing and sad and disgusting knowledge. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, and good luck to you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
We were just listening to Rebecca Campbell from the Progressive Magazine and from the Wisconsin Citizen Media Co-op. And again, you can catch her at WCMCOOP.com and progressive.org. This is an end to my show, but this is only a beginning for the resurgence of the progressive ideas. These ideals cut across party lines and are here to better our families and our communities, our country, and our Wisconsin. We believe in protecting the things we care about, our children, our homes, our rivers, lakes, and forests, and our idea that all men and women were created equal, no matter who you are, what you believed in, or who you love. this movement will continue on, and it will continue on one voice at a time.